Hi, good afternoon. Welcome to CSIS. Thank you all for coming on relatively short notice, just after the end of the holiday. We're thrilled today to be able to bring together such a distinguished group of speakers at such an opportune moment. There's just been a lot of activity, a lot of excellent new reporting that's come out on Somalia, and a lot of new thinking we'll hear about. And we've been looking to really try and take account and bring some of these different threads together as the summer came to a close. And as it turned out, many of the key personalities were, in fact, available and willing to come and join us here today as we kick off the fall season. So on behalf of CSIS, certainly thank you all, our speakers, for making the effort and coming here to be with us today. We're doing this event jointly with our friends, U.S. Institute of Peace. David Smock will preside over this session, introduce the speakers, and guide the discussion. We're going to have to be very practical in the way we break up this. Jim Swan's going to open up and take some questions and comments and answers, and have to leave a little earlier than the formal conclusion. We're able to go all the way till 5 p.m. with the full spectrum of our speakers. I want to single out David Hennick especially for all of his efforts in putting this entire program together. It took quite a bit of effort, and David, thank you so much for doing that. This is on the record. We have media here, and so I would just ask everyone to, when we get into the question and answer period, be very succinct and to the point as far as comments and questions, so we can have as lively and informal and open an exchange as possible. So thank you again for coming with us, David.
Join with Steve in welcoming you all and thanking you for coming, and particularly thanking our speakers for making presentations today. As Steve said, we'll hear first from Jim Swan, and he will take some questions, and then he will need to depart, and then we'll turn to the other three speakers, and they will speak, and then we'll hold the questions till the end of their presentations. But James Swan is Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. He's been in that position since December of 2006. He's in charge of Central Africa, East Africa, and regional security affairs. He came to the Bureau from Intelligence and Research, where he was Director of Analysis for Africa. Earlier in his Foreign Service career, he has served in embassies in Kinshasa and Brazzaville, and he also served as Somali watcher in Nairobi. So he comes with some considerable background experience on Somalia, and we're pleased to turn to you, Jim, to lead us off.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much, Steve and David, for your introduction. I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to discuss U.S. policy in Somalia and also our engagement with Somalia more generally. The last several months have been busy in Somalia and throughout the Horn of Africa. And while these have been difficult times, we should not lose sight of the future and the opportunities in front of the Somali people today. Through the framework outlined by the transitional federal charter, there remains an opportunity to rebuild Somalia and to restore effective governance representative of all aspects of Somali society. There will be many additional challenges before we get there, but this is our common goal, and we must work purposefully toward it. Before I start to discuss the current situation and the way forward in Somalia, I'd like to take a few minutes to look back over developments of the past few months. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Jendai Fraser, my boss, spoke here at CSIS in January. And that was just at the moment when the Council of Islamic Courts had collapsed. It ceased to function as an organization. The Council of Islamic Courts had refused to join the governance process and the transitional federal institutions through peaceful dialogue, instead demonstrating to the international community that they were not interested in being part of a long-term political solution for Somalia. Instead, the courts chose to provoke Ethiopia into launching a counteroffensive against continued Council of Islamic Courts military expansion. And ultimately, this provocation cost the Council of Islamic Courts the support of the Somali people and sealed its own fate and rapid demise as a political entity. The months following the collapse of the Council of Islamic Courts have been difficult and frequently frustrating for all involved in Somalia. While the leadership of the transitional federal government has made its share of mistakes, the United States government is most concerned by the rise in violent extremism, largely perpetrated by violent and radical al-Shabaab militia that had previously hijacked the Council of Islamic Courts towards an agenda of military expansion, terrorism, and aggression. Recently, these extremist attacks have deliberately targeted moderate and respected political figures and journalists who are essential to lasting political accommodation in Somalia. This violent extremism is designed to undermine an inclusive political process and prevent the establishment of lasting peace and stability, and it must not be tolerated. While there are genuine opposition voices that should be brought into the political process, we must emphasize that violence is not acceptable as a means of achieving political objectives and encourage instead all Somalis to participate in a genuine, nonviolent political process. At the same time, we must work toward an effective ceasefire arrangement that will help achieve these objectives, reduce the level of violence in Mogadishu, and prevent further deaths of innocent civilians. In our view, the key to long-term stability in Somalia lies in a continued process of inclusive dialogue and reconciliation that will prepare the way for election of a permanent government in 2009, as called for by the Transitional Federal Charter. As Assistant Secretary Fraser outlined in January here, there are three primary U.S. policy priorities for Somalia. First, to encourage inclusive political dialogue between the transitional federal institutions and other key Somali stakeholders. Second, to move forward with the deployment of an African stabilization force in Somalia. Third, to work with our donor partners, our international donor partners, on programs of assistance to support the constitutional process outlined by the Charter, to help build the capacity of the transitional federal institutions, and to provide much-needed social services for the Somali people, and finally, to respond to the humanitarian needs of the Somali people. So again, three priorities: inclusive political dialogue, deployment of the African Union peace support operation, and third, a robust program of international assistance to support the capacity of the Somali government and to respond to the needs of the Somali people. We've made headway over the past few months in several of these areas, particularly in mobilizing donor resources and supporting the initial deployment of the African Union mission in Somalia. The United States actively supported the deployment of approximately 1,600 Ugandan troops as the lead element of AMISOM, or the African Union mission in Somalia. As I said, deployment of AMISOM is a critical element in helping to stabilize Somalia and to create conditions for lasting political reconciliation. AMISOM will help create conditions for the reduction of Ethiopian forces and their eventual departure from Somalia. Americans, Somalis, and Ethiopians alike all understand that an Ethiopian military presence is not a long-term solution to insecurity in Somalia. Earlier this year, the United States identified $19.6 million to assist AMISOM forces. Approximately $10 million of that aid was used to furnish equipment and provide airlift for the deployment of Uganda's AMISOM contingent. Congress subsequently appropriated a further $40 million in funding to support AMISOM, and we're continuing to provide support to other troop-contributing countries. On August 27th, the United States began training two battalions of Burundian troops under the African Contingent Training and Assistance Program, as well as preparing to provide equipment in support of the Burundian contingent for AMISOM. The United States will provide $5.6 million in equipment in addition to the ACOTA training to support Burundi's deployment. Meanwhile, our donor partners have also worked to make resources available to support AMISOM's important mission. In addition, we've worked closely with other international partners, such as the United Kingdom, to maintain focus and momentum within the UN Security Council on moving towards a transition to a UN peacekeeping operation as a successor to AMISOM. With respect to the National Reconciliation Congress, the donor community reacted quickly to make funds available in support of that Congress, including a contribution of $1.25 million from the United States. Overall, our assistance program for Somalia in fiscal year 2007 included the assistance that I just mentioned, in addition to more than $64 million in humanitarian assistance, $10 million in development assistance, and we're continuing to make additional resources available to respond to emerging needs. But most important to restoring stability and governance to Somalia is the path to establishment of permanent governing institutions at the end of the transition period in 2009. To a great extent, this process will be driven by the transitional government's willingness to create an enabling environment for inclusive political dialogue. But it also requires that all Somali stakeholders, not just the transitional government, but all Somali stakeholders, seize this opportunity and choose to engage in a genuine political process and work within that transitional process based on the transitional federal charter. These objectives that I've outlined, of course, reflect U.S. policy, but they also reflect an international consensus on Somalia, formed through discussions within the International Contact Group on Somalia and the International Advisory Committee for the National Reconciliation Congress. As a founding member of both groups, the United States has worked closely with its regional and international partners in seeking a way forward on Somalia. Through the Contact Group and the International Advisory Committee, the international community has repeatedly reaffirmed its strong commitment to supporting a sustainable political solution in Somalia, again, through broad-based national dialogue and by providing appropriate development, security, and humanitarian assistance. During recent months, the United States has been actively working with our international donor and regional partners to ensure that the National Reconciliation Congress provided the mechanism for genuine political dialogue among all key Somali stakeholders. Our goals for the Congress were clear: achieve equitable representation in the transitional federal institutions and agreement on a roadmap for the remainder of the transitional process. Unfortunately, due to lack of participation from some key opposition figures, despite repeated invitations from the Congress managers and encouragement from the international community, the Congress has not yet fully achieved these objectives. Following an initial period of social reconciliation at the Congress, the second political phase of the Congress, the National Reconciliation Congress, concluded on August 30th. Yet the process of political dialogue and accommodation is by no means complete. As long as important segments of Somali society remain outside of the political process, the Congress stands ready and has so announced that it is prepared to reconvene and provide the framework for inclusive dialogue when other opposition figures are ready to join in a nonviolent political process. At the same time, the transitional federal government's leadership must now implement the recommendations of the Congress in good faith and in keeping with the spirit of national dialogue and reconciliation. In moving forward with the transitional process, all transitional committees appointed by the transitional government must be fully inclusive of all stakeholders, including those who may not have participated themselves in the Congress. So that is to say, as we begin to move forward with establishing the other bodies, such as an electoral commission, a constitution drafting commission, etc., leading to the transition, it's important that those bodies be broadly inclusive, even of groups that may not have participated in the Congress. None of the individual policies that I've outlined earlier can succeed alone. In order to achieve lasting security in Somalia, we need to see political dialogue and accommodation among Somalis, improvement in Somalis in the Somali government's capacity, training of a representative, competent, and respected Somali security force, and forward movement on the transitional tasks outlined in the transitional federal charter that will lead to national elections and the establishment of permanent governance institutions in 2009. And the United States will continue to work with our donor partners and our African partners to advance these objectives. So in conclusion, at this stage, we think it's important for the Somali people to look to the future, moving forward in the transitional political process as envisioned by the Charter, not focusing solely on the current composition of the transitional federal government and its institutions. As in Liberia or the Democratic Republic of the Congo during their transitions, the transitional federal institutions are not permanent institutions. Rather, they offer a transitional mechanism that provides a framework for achieving the objectives outlined in the Charter and the formation of representative governance institutions at the end of the transitional process. We understand this is an ongoing process, and we have not reached the end. But along with our regional and international partners, the United States will remain engaged in supporting this process of inclusive dialogue, however long it may last, while also responding to the humanitarian needs of the Somali people. Thanks very much. I'd be happy to take a few questions.
We will have time for a few questions before Jim departs. Maybe I can start it off by saying that when Assistant Secretary Frazier was here and spoke, one of the encouraging elements of her presentation was her insistence that the TFG would become more inclusive of opposition figures, moderate representatives of the courts and other opposition figures, and that this would be something that the U.S. government would be pushing hard on. In your presentation, I didn't hear much about power sharing. I heard a lot about inclusive dialogue. I heard about inclusive participation in the Electoral Commission and steps moving forward, but I wonder if you'd say something about the administration's assessment of the degree to which the TFG has reached out and been inclusive in terms of power sharing, as I believe the administration had hoped it would do.
Thanks very much. First of all, of course, the transitional government has placed a great deal of emphasis on the National Reconciliation Congress as a vehicle for political dialogue leading to political accommodation of other segments in society. As I mentioned in my remarks, we think there's been some progress here, but that more still needs to be done in terms of ensuring a broad-based representation of all elements of society. And that's why we also believe it's important to look ahead to the entire extent of the transitional process, which is not merely the institutions that are in place today, but also a number of other institutions that are responsible for preparing the eventual election in 2009 of permanent institutions. Uh-oh. Good Lord. I hope that wasn't.
Last point, just for
you. Did you notice the little notch there?
I see. I see that Steve's getting a little emotional, but that as we look out to 2009, this provides other opportunities for a broad array of groups that may not feel adequately represented currently in the institutions to be included. And we think it's very important that that happen. But as I think you'll know if you've followed our comments throughout the past several months, that we have been very actively encouraging the transitional governing institutions to reach out, to broaden their base, to be more inclusive, and we would still like to see that happen, but also in the context of the many other opportunities for inclusiveness that may exist between now and 2009.
With that little melody, just remind everybody to turn off their cell phones. Yes. You want to identify yourself?
My name is Abdulkadir Abdurrahman. I represent the Somali American Peace Council. One area that the secretary... One area the secretary has forgot to mention is that the Ethiopian occupation and what it's causing in Somalia. There was an exodus of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people from Mogadishu. It was caused by Ethiopian shelling and murder and rape. And it's unfortunate when we Sudanese shell Darfur, we call it a genocide. But when Ethiopians shell the civilian population in Mogadishu, we call it a mercy mission. Could you please respond to my question? Why are we ignoring that point?
As I mentioned in my remarks, and as I think has been repeated many times by our Assistant Secretary and others, the United States is eager to find an opportunity for the Ethiopians to depart Somalia when conditions permit that to happen. And we think that what's going to be necessary in terms of creating such conditions is first and foremost to proceed quickly with the deployment of the African Union Peace Stabilization Mission. And that is why, although this is obviously an African-led process, we are doing a great deal in terms of providing financial and other support to assist the African Union mission to deploy quickly. That's going to be important to create conditions in which Ethiopian forces can depart. It's also going to be important, clearly, for a more stable political environment to be created and for the transitional federal government and for its security forces to have improved capacity in terms of providing security. And so those are going to be other important companion elements. But the most important, clearly, is going to be for AMISOM to deploy. And there are a number of local factors, frankly, that would contribute perhaps to a more rapid deployment of AMISOM, including a ceasefire, a cessation of active attacks on civilian moderates, and a cessation of active attacks on AMISOM forces themselves might help to create conditions in which deployment could proceed more rapidly and we could get to the objective that, as I said in my remarks, I think is shared by all, which is for the Ethiopians to depart as soon as it's practical to do that in a way that does not leave a security vacuum.
Questions or comments?
Yes. My name is Abdul Karim Jama. I'm also with the Somali American Peace Council. The departure of the Ethiopian forces is an important factor in finding peace in Somalia. And the transitional federal government will not be able to survive without the presence of Ethiopian forces. To get around that and give more credibility to the transitional federal government, some form of power sharing is important, as you mentioned. Is it useful, you think, for the U.S. government to make its assistance conditional to some form of power sharing so that there are some certain benchmarks that the TFG will have to meet before they can get assistance, or we're just hoping that they will do that out of their own self-interest or intelligence? Thank you.
The transitional government clearly has tremendous needs. And by extension, the Somali people have tremendous needs, and some of those needs, it's important that they be met from their own governing institutions. Somalia has obviously had a terrible lack of governance, lack of capacity, and we think it's important that we move ahead and find ways to try to bolster the capacity of the transitional federal government that was, of course, established through a process of dialogue and reconciliation in 2004. So we want to continue to look at ways in which we can provide some capacity building. As I mentioned, this is a consensus approach within the International Contact Group on Somalia and other international partners with respect to Somalia. But we've also made very clear to the transitional federal government that we think it's important that it broaden its base and reach out and seek to be more inclusive, not only in its existing structures, but again, looking out to 2009 and the preparations for the transition in 2009.
I do agree with, Ted Danye, Congressional Research Service, with most of the objectives that you outlined. The question really is, do we really mean it? And do we really forcefully push the objectives that we outline for implementation? Take, for example, the issue of inclusive participation and the reconciliation process. There hasn't been contact between U.S. government officials and some of those opposition. Now, in several months, I would say since the early days when the Ethiopians moved in, some of the leadership of the courts, we met with them at the ambassadorial level in Yemen, in Kenya, and so forth, but there hasn't been much follow-through. In fact, we did ask Abdullahi Yusuf if he's open to the idea of sitting down with moderate elements of the opposition. And his response was, as long as they're not terrorists and fundamentalists. Now, who makes that determination? He himself? And if that's the case, what's the definition of a fundamentalist? I think while the objectives are, I think, worthwhile pursuing, but implementation of those objectives, unless they're pursued aggressively, we're going to end up with the same thing. Lastly, a couple of minor factual points to make. You said Ethiopia was provoked into going in here. The fact of the matter is that the Islamic courts did not have the military might, nor did they project their military force even closer to the Ethiopian border. They did not have any presence. Ethiopia had presence in Somalia illegally. The consensus, even within our own government, was that none of the immediate neighboring countries should even participate as a peacekeeping operation. I think at the end of the day, you may have issues with some individuals in the courts, but they did bring stability in the 6 months that they were in power. Those who prevented the TFG from assuming the capital and establishing government are the same warlords who are currently ministers in the transitional federal government. So I think while outlining the objective is key, but implementation, and if you could address those, maybe I'm wrong that you have actually pursued it, that you've reached out to the 36 parliament members scattered throughout the region, as well as some of the ministers.
Thanks. Well, I'm first of all, I'm pleased if we have the objectives right. That's a good start, I think. With respect to reaching out to moderate elements, we've actually been encouraged by statements, certainly by Ali Mahdi, the organizer of the National Reconciliation Congress, by Yusuf and other senior people within the transitional federal government, indicating, again, that the Congress is open, that they are eager to see inclusion of groups that are not currently participating. And I think it's very significant that in the final, we understand, will be among the final recommendations of the transitional Congress, it will explicitly state that the door remains open, that the Congress continues to be seized with these important issues of national reconciliation and political accommodation, and that it's going to be important, therefore, should opportunities arise for others to become participants in this process, that door remains open. The Congress can be reconvened at any moment to continue to take up those issues. So I think that there is a sincerity with respect to seeking to be more inclusive with these other groups that have not participated in there previously. Let me just, with respect to some of the specific comments that you made, again, on the provocation of Ethiopia, I think perhaps we just disagree on that, but it's clear that the transitional government had invited the Ethiopians in to provide protection to that government, that the Islamic courts were actively moving in the vicinity of Baidoa, the transitional federal government's capital. There was extensive skirmishing there, and that the Ethiopians responded at the behest of the TFG to a request for its protection. And clearly, the Council of Islamic Courts had repeatedly asserted its irredentist claims on Ethiopian territory. So our analysis is that, indeed, this was a provocation of Ethiopia. I think we also disagree, frankly, on the characterization of a period of stability during the period in which the Council of Islamic Courts was in a leadership role in Mogadishu. On the contrary, it seems to us this was a period in which the Council of Islamic Courts, despite some initial expectations that all would remain calm in Mogadishu and elsewhere, but very quickly we saw the Council of Islamic Courts move very aggressively against Johar, subsequently up as far as Galkayo, south to Kismayo, and as I mentioned, particularly aggressive moves against Baidoa shortly before the Ethiopians intervened. So I think there's we have a different assessment, frankly, of the extent to which the Council of Islamic Courts was a force for peace versus, in our view, a force that was ultimately brought much greater violence to southern Somalia.
We'll take one last question from Steve, and then we'll let Jim go.
Jim, the last several months it's become much more apparent just how embedded the Ethiopia-Eritrean conflict is within this conflict of Somalia itself, and it's taken various forms, and it's become apparent that the conflict within the Ogaden and the Eritrean role and the like. Can you comment on, first of all, the debate or the issue surrounding the possible designation or designation of Eritrea as a state sponsor of terror, and sort of how the thinking around that issue today sits and what the implications are moving in that direction? And secondly, can you comment on the position of the Ethiopians? Has there been any shift in their perspective vis-a-vis the TFG's behavior and the degree to which the TFG has shown such little progress in enlarging its consortium and yielding any space and enlisting any of its opponents into this particular domain? Have the Ethiopians conveyed to us any shift of their own sort of strategy or views on what's needed to get some kind of new political reality that might permit them to really seriously begin thinking about withdrawal, drawdown of their forces?
First, with respect to possible designation of Eritrea as a state sponsor, the Assistant Secretary Fraser did speak to this recently to the press. I think at, frankly, a very basic level, we've seen extensive reporting indicating Eritrean arms shipments into Somalia. We have seen, including through the monitoring group report and other reporting, And as a consequence, we're concerned that this may indeed represent efforts by a state to contribute to activities that are indeed terrorist activities within Somalia. But we're at an early stage of reviewing this, and we'll continue to do so. With respect to the Ethiopian views of outreach by the transitional federal government in Somalia. We've had extensive conversations with the Ethiopian government on this issue, and we've certainly been assured repeatedly that indeed the Ethiopians believe that it is important that the transitional government broaden its base and ensure that it is widely representative. I think, again, as I mentioned in my remarks, I think the Ethiopians are eager to find an opportunity to depart under the proper conditions and recognize that this is not their continued presence is not a long-term solution. But this means getting AMISOM deployed. It also means finding ways to improve stability in Somalia, and one of those ways is certainly through a more broadly representative political process. Thanks. Thank you very much, by the way. I have some other colleagues from the office who will be here, too, to make sure that we benefit from all of your other questions and the other panelists. So thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Jim. Our next presenter is Leslie Lefko, who is Special Initiatives Researcher for Human Rights Watch in the Africa Division and principal author of this very important report that is available in hard copy, but I believe also on your website, and it makes fascinating reading. Leslie is an expert on Sudan, Cote d'Ivoire, and Ethiopia. She's worked on several different parts of Africa, looking at abuses in armed conflicts. And before this work, she was involved in humanitarian activities for Medecins Sans Frontières between 1997 and 2002, working in Sudan, in DRC, and in Sierra Leone. But today she's going to address this report to us. Leslie.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for hosting this this event. I have to say, I do quail a bit at being called an expert on anything in the region when Ken Menkaus is sitting right down the line. But in any event, I was involved in the work on Somalia. Let me just start with an observation. I have been working documenting abuses in armed conflicts for more than a decade in the region. In West Africa, and one thing that struck me very vividly when I started the research for this report was just how a crisis of this magnitude and crimes of this scale could seem to fall so quietly in the international media and in the international community. I think what we've seen in Mogadishu over the last 6 to 8 months, there's really very little comparison when you look around the world in terms of the gravity of the crimes, the scale of displacement that we've seen. And it certainly has begged the question in my mind, you know, what was it about the Horn of Africa, what is it about Somalia that has made the response so different? You know, when you look, for example, in 2006 at what happened in Lebanon, just in terms of the scale of displacement, the scale of perhaps civilian deaths, you're talking perhaps of comparable numbers. And yet, of course, the response and the attention has been significantly different. And, of course, I think one issue is probably just the fact that there has been such a minimal presence of the media, of international agencies in Somalia for many, many years. And doing this kind of research and doing reporting is not easy. There's no question of that. Having said that, I feel, you know, we've put this report together. It took, it was about based on about 6 weeks of field research. And I'll just give you just a minute on the methodology, because this question often comes up in discussing our reports of, you know, how we get our information, how we verify the facts that we present in our reports. And basically, the keystone of our work is eyewitness testimony, is the testimony of people who are either victims or witnesses to the events that we describe. And we managed to interview more than 100 victims and eyewitnesses of the events in Mogadishu. Only a fraction of that research is actually presented in the report. We have many, many other testimonies that we did not quote or use in any way. So we're very confident about the quality of the research that went into this. We managed to visit not only Mogadishu, but also Galkayo, Bosaso, Hargeisa, and we spent some time interviewing people who had fled Mogadishu into Kenya. So we managed to talk to people in a wide variety of places and independently corroborate the same events by speaking to people in different places. Let me just briefly present some of the findings, because I have a feeling that not all of you have read the 100-plus pages of the report. Basically, we look at three of the key warring parties. We look at the insurgency, what we call the insurgency. Of course, others may have, there may be questions about why we use this term. We use the term more or less as a catch-all, without any political implications there. By insurgency, we mean a loose grouping of different armed groups. The Shabab, or remnants of the Shabab, clan militia, and other armed actors. And generally, we weren't always able to distinguish exactly which one of these armed groups was responsible for a particular incident. But we loosely lump the different abuses as the responsibility of insurgent groups. The abuses by the insurgency fall into several different categories. Number one, we have their deployment in populated civilian areas and their use of civilian neighborhoods to launch attacks. Now, this is a fundamental problem under humanitarian law, using populated civilian neighborhoods to launch attacks. And it's obviously been a key factor in the violence that we've seen in Mogadishu. We also condemn their use of mortars, often indiscriminately, their launching of mortars at Ethiopian and TFG forces, because these kinds of attacks were often not guided. The mortars were just launched from civilian neighborhoods. They did not have any kind of guidance system for the mortars, so the mortars could land here, they could land there. Civilians were often the victims of the attacks, where the mortars did not hit their intended targets. This is a problem that we go into some detail in the report. We also look at the kind of threats that different groups in the insurgency made to civilians when there were protests about their activities. We managed to document a number of cases where neighborhoods in Mogadishu made serious efforts to stop their neighborhoods being used by the insurgents. And people were either often threatened. In some cases, people were actually killed by the insurgent groups when they tried to stop their neighborhoods being used. And finally, we look at the insurgents' treatment of captured combatants. Some of you may remember in March, late March, there was a key incident where the TFG launched its first disarmament operation of some Mogadishu neighborhoods. And this ended up being a bit of a debacle, and at least 20 TFG troops were captured, and some of their bodies were then dragged through the streets. And this, of course, is another fundamental violation of humanitarian law, and one that we look into in some detail. So that's very briefly the insurgents. And, of course, I'm happy to go into more detail later on any of this. Then we look at the Ethiopians and the TFG forces. In terms of the Ethiopian forces, I think we can, broadly speaking, we can divide the activities of the TFG and the Ethiopians into sort of two broad areas. When we looked at the kind of organized military campaign that was going on in March and April, this was mainly coordinated and led and implemented by the Ethiopians. The use of heavy artillery, the use of other heavy weaponry as part of their campaign of bombardment of those neighborhoods that were thought to be insurgent strongholds. This was mainly implemented by the Ethiopian forces, our research concluded. The TFG forces actually played a very minor role. In some cases, going in with Ethiopian ground troops into neighborhoods after the bombardment was mainly concluded, and then trying to do operations in those neighborhoods. But Ethiopian troops, by and large, led the way. One more note on the conduct of the Ethiopian forces. An area that was of particular concern to us is the treatment of medical facilities. We go into this in some detail in the report because we investigated and concluded that there was a pattern of attacks on hospitals. There are at least three key hospitals that we looked into in some detail, Al-Arafat, Al-Hayat, and SOS. And although these hospitals are located, they were in hot areas, they were in frontline areas, what we see was not only attacks, for example, from shelling or from Katyusha rocket barrages, but also Ethiopian occupation of two of those hospitals for extended period of time, and looting and vandalization of the facilities. And these are all, again, serious violations of the laws of war, and resulted, we believe, in deprivation of access to health care for many, many civilians in Mogadishu. Moving to the TFG forces, as I said, in terms of the serious military operations in March and April, we concluded that they played a lesser role in terms of the direct bombardment that was taking place, but the TFG forces have actually been responsible for the bulk of the looting and harassment of individuals, civilians, in Mogadishu. a later pattern of abuse that we mention in the report, but that isn't so closely linked to the March-April events, is something that's ongoing now, so it's very much worth mentioning, which is mass arrests and detentions of particularly young men in Mogadishu. And we're seeing this, you know, as I said, it's happening, it's continuing to happen. Many of these people are being detained not only in official police stations and official detention centers, but also in informal, unofficial detention centers. For example, some of you may know the name Barista Hizbiga, the former, one of the former detention facilities under the Siad Barre government, which is located near Villa Somalia. And that is an underground bunker where we've received quite a bit of testimony about dozens of people being held in worrisome conditions in these facilities. This, as I mentioned, is a concern because it is ongoing. These kinds of operations are continuing. That, very broadly speaking, are sort of the patterns of abuses that we document in the report. These have developed, these have evolved a little bit even since the research that we did in May. Right now, according to the latest information we've been receiving, we are hearing more and more of insurgent attacks on Ethiopian bases at night, with fighting and crossfire and civilian casualties taking place at night. There continue to be a pattern of targeted assassinations and killings of TFG officials by various armed groups. It's not always clear who is responsible for these attacks. So again, I think that the patterns of violence, they are perhaps changing slightly, but they are continuing at very high levels, with civilians often the main victims of many of these attacks. I'd like to just mention briefly a couple of our key recommendations. As I mentioned at the beginning, one of the things that struck me is the lack of attention given the seriousness of what are very clearly international crimes, and by that I mean war crimes, very serious breaches of the Geneva Conventions, of the laws of war. And one of the things that we are recommending and hope will come about in the coming weeks and months would be an improved human rights monitoring and reporting presence in Somalia. As many of you may know, the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has a very minimal presence in Nairobi, but we believe and hope that this presence could be expanded, and that having this kind of institutional expertise in the region, on the ground, not necessarily in Mogadishu, given all the constraints, but in other parts of Somalia, doing regular monitoring, doing regular reporting, doing the kind of verification of incidents that is difficult to do but I think can be done, this would be a very important tool to raise more awareness about the very serious human rights issues, which at the moment I think are not nearly as central on the agenda as they should be. In addition, there clearly needs to be greater attention to accountability. You know, we are looking, of course, not just at accountability for crimes in the last 6 months, ideally accountability for crimes over far longer than that. Now, this is not easy, it is not obvious, but we certainly believe that looking at a future stable Somalia means addressing some of the very serious crimes that have taken place and setting in place mechanisms that can provide accountability. It's not going to be easy. I think it's not obvious, but it's something that at the moment seems to be totally off the table, and I think it needs to be brought on and made a much more central part of discussions. I will leave it there for now, but of course I'm happy to address anything in more detail in the question and answer period.
Thank you very much, Leslie, and I do commend the report to you. It's worth looking at in with care and in detail. Our next presenter is Jeff Lone, who is head of the regional delegation of the ICRC here in the U.S. He has principal responsibility for relating to the U.S. government, and among his responsibilities is monitoring the situation in Guantanamo, not an enviable task. He has served in various other places for ICRC, including a decade spent in the Horn of Africa, so he approaches the issues relating to Somalia with considerable background and expertise, and we appreciate Jeff joining us today.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today and to address you and to share both some thoughts as well as to hear other discussions from people. I think what I can best bring to this discussion and talk to is the general framework of humanitarian operations and humanitarian action in Somalia. That's the primary concern of my organization. It's the primary concern of many of us who work there and who have worked there for a number of years. And in saying that, I make an appeal that we often make for respecting the value of independent humanitarian action, regardless of the causes and background to armed conflict. There are nonetheless always victims amongst the civilian population, and unfortunately Somalia has seen more than its fair share over the past decades, and those victims are ones that we try to reach irrespective of what generated their suffering. And our view remains and will continue to remain and to promote the priority of addressing the needs of the civilian population who are affected by violence, and this from a humanitarian perspective almost always must be kept in mind, and the particularity and the specificity of the Somali context is one that makes that a very definite challenge. The absence of the normal infrastructure and administrative machinery of government makes it extremely difficult to provide humanitarian support, and the presence of armed conflict and violence in society compounds those difficulties. With some other organizations, we have been present, and that's what I want to talk a little bit about. We've been present in Somalia for 30 years. Those 30 years of presence of our organization and what we've been trying to do, I think, have been characterized by certain spikes and certain troughs in terms of the delivery of support, the delivery of protection and assistance. And certainly the peak was in the early 90s when it was it dominated our humanitarian agenda and dominated a lot of what we did during that period. And we continue to maintain a presence there. Even if our presence is at a lower level than it was then, it's still extremely important. It is certainly one of the main humanitarian operations we have, and I think will certainly continue to be. Let me talk a bit about the two things, the conditions of working in Somalia and then the characteristics of the work that we're doing, and I think those who promote independent humanitarian action are also trying to do. And I think the three elements that I share with you that come from an operational experience of ours, first of all, is the importance and the value, not only because there isn't a well-functioning infrastructure, but also in general, of a dialogue with everybody, with all the stakeholders in the Somali context, those who carry political authority, those who carry military authority, those who carry civilian or just in positions of influence and good counsel require a continuous dialogue with and a dialogue that is always difficult in situations of insecurity. But that dialogue is a precondition to being able to operate effectively. It's a precondition to being able to guarantee the type of security that is required to have a presence and to be able to bring some support. The second one is the importance and the need to take a long view and to have a long-standing presence. Again, regardless of the form that violence takes or the antecedents of that violence, it is a presence in a community. It is, we believe, a presence amongst Somali communities over a protracted period of time that allows organizations, that allows humanitarian intervention to take place in safety and security and on behalf of the victims. And the third component that is absolutely critical is a relationship with local community organisations who can support the type of interventions that are needed in these insecure environments. These conditions allow for deployment of humanitarian action and certainly allow the delivery of emergency assistance. And without them, without one of them, it's very difficult to be able to reach. I'm making these points because it's a difficult operating environment for humanitarian organisations. We all know that. Several remarks have been made about that already this afternoon. And because of that, the level of humanitarian assistance required is not delivered to the extent that I think any of us would like to see it delivered. And certainly from the point of view of those who require it, there is a deficit. Let me address three elements of the characteristics of humanitarian operations, and this is current as well as in the immediate past. The first one is flexibility. It is extremely important to be able to adapt operations to the scale and the urgency of needs as they develop, as they appear in specific regions. This means nothing more than understanding that actually one can have a crisis fairly quickly, fairly rapidly in Somalia. It can happen really within days, and one does need to be able to scale down operations and reintroduce them in other places at short notice. It's unfortunately an indication of the vulnerability of Somali civil society. Secondly is the need to recognise that any humanitarian operations have to address the capacity of organisations to deliver. It is a context where the needs have historically exceeded the capacity of agencies to respond to them, and it is extremely important to make a triage and to be able to decide on what are the priorities and how to respond to the priorities that are set, and not to try to achieve more than can be done, because organisational capacity will always be a constraint and will always limit what can be done. And the third and related point is, of course, to link that in with priorities. We think there are really two forms of priorities. The first one, and one that has historically dominated, is to be able to respond to emergencies. That's one that we have seen certainly this year. We certainly saw it last year for very different reasons. But there is the emergency response capacity is one that continues to be of main concern, and one that I'll talk about finally in a minute. And the second priority is to look more at the short and medium term infrastructure capacity within Somali society, and we're speaking here about promoting and developing livelihood, means of production, supporting water supply infrastructure, and healthcare facilities. This year has seen an increase in emergency humanitarian operations. An increase at the expense of doing more medium-term planning, and that increase has focused on a number of areas, unsurprisingly. The wounded have been a priority, they remain a priority of humanitarian concern, and thousands of persons have been treated for surgical interventions in a variety of hospitals and medical structures throughout the country. In addition to that, the basic items, water, food, household items, shelter, these have been the main requirements for the hundreds of thousands of persons who have been displaced this year as well as in other years because of armed conflict and violence. And I think the delivery of those basic commodities, extremely basic commodities, has been something that for those of us who continue to work there remains a priority and is likely to remain one. And we've been feeding about 200,000 people over the past months and anticipate to continue over the coming months. And in the long term, we would like as an organisation, I think, to revert to being able to provide some support to infrastructure, being able to provide some support to community capacity, being able to provide some support to the type of structures that will allow communities to take care of their own needs in a more effective and efficient way. But as of now, the emergency operations are continuing to dominate. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff. Our final presenter is Ken Menkhouse, who's a professor of political science at Davidson College in North Carolina, specializing in African politics, and particularly on Somalia. He's served as a consultant in times past to the U.S. government, to the U.N., to non-governmental organizations, U.S. Army Peacekeeping Institute, and others. But the most remarkable and impressive thing about Ken is that he has stuck with Somalia, and he has remained faithful to that commitment, and he has been a very thoughtful and insightful observer of events in Somalia, and I'm sure he'll share those with us today.
Thanks so much, David. I'd like to begin by saying that politically, this is the worst situation I have seen in Somalia in about 14 years, the last time I remember being this anxious and perplexed about where Somalia was going was in the darkest days of the UNISOM operation when it faced General Adid's insurgency, and things just seemed to be unraveling. There are fewer hopeful options to look forward to. The options that have been outlined by Deputy Assistant Secretary Swan are entirely valid, but when placed against a political analysis of where the country is actually going, does not leave a lot of room for hope. There are fewer and fewer groups in Somalia, who both internal and external, who seem to be working for the right kinds of outcomes. No one to root for, really, except the people who are caught in the middle, and they're all being killed. And one of the great tragedies in Somalia right now is that a very promising group of civil society operatives and other Somalis of goodwill who do try to make the right thing happen in Somalia are being threatened chronically. They're leaving the country. They are afraid to talk. I have never faced a situation since the worst days of the Siad Barre regime where I have encountered Somalis more afraid to talk. And when they are killed or targeted, one of the great mysteries is always we never know who did it, because it's equally plausible that they were assassinated either by the Shabab or by the TFG or potentially even by the Ethiopians. This is not good news. The Somali crisis is also, I think, it's a point of departure. It's also important to build on what Jim Swan said about with regard to, and I guess it was prompted by Steve's question about Eritrea and Ethiopia. We can't understand what's going on in Somalia today, and we certainly aren't going to solve the problem in Somalia today, nor are Somalis, unless we understand it as part of an interlocked system of crises in the Horn of Africa. This is a conflict complex now in the Horn of Africa, and three conflicts in particular are very much interlinked. The Ethiopia-Eritrea conflict, the Somalia insurgency and counterinsurgency in Mogadishu, and then the crisis we haven't spoken about yet, but I will spend some time on, and that is the crisis in eastern Ethiopia and Somali regional state there. Every single event in one has implications for the other, and that is making it even harder to resolve those particular conflicts. To go back to my pessimism, let me give you a quick situation analysis based on a summer in the region. I just came back from Nairobi last night, actually, and had a chance in Nairobi to get some very fresh data and analysis from a range of humanitarian groups that were at the OCHA, the Officer of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs workshop there. By any objective standard, what's going on in Somalia and Somali regional state in eastern Ethiopia is catastrophic. And I share Leslie's shock at how immune we've become to reacting to what is absolutely unacceptable in Somalia. Our threshold for what constitutes an emergency there seems to be growing and growing. We start with the humanitarian. In Mogadishu, we still have over 300,000 people in a city of 1.3 million who are displaced. They've been displaced now since April. Large sections of the cities are the city are unsafe to return to. There are hundreds of thousands more of IDPs who have fled fighting from earlier periods as well, concentrated in the lower and middle Shabelle of the country, but also up in Hiran, Mudug, and Galgadud. Those are the three areas that are currently receiving some of the heaviest concentrations of IDPs. Food security and malnutrition in all of those areas is extremely bad. The figures that I saw 48 hours ago coming from OCHA suggest that acute malnutrition among children in the Shabelle Valley is over 25%. And they're looking at a very, very serious humanitarian crisis there in a context in which humanitarian space is shrinking and shrinking. It is very difficult to operate there because of security reasons. So the humanitarian crisis alone warrants close attention. Economically, business is way down. The past 6-8 months now, since the intervention by the Ethiopians and the ensuing insurgency, have been disastrous for the flow of commerce. Commerce has been, for a variety of reasons, in part because of insecurity and displacement, purchasing power is down, in part because of roadblocks which have proliferated throughout Mogadishu and surrounding areas, mainly manned by transitional federal government security forces themselves. Extortion by the transitional federal government at or top officials, I should be more clear, of the TFG, extortion of leading businessmen by those officials, the insistence on large prepayments of taxes for the right to move goods through the seaports, which is discouraging business, threats against the business community by both the Shabab insurgents if the businessmen pay the TFG, and threats from the TFG in Ethiopia if they're seen in any way as collaborating. Again, just part of the group that's caught in the middle, and what we're seeing is many to most who have the means are simply leaving the country. In addition, the NGO community, the international NGO community, as well as local NGOs, are under tremendous pressure from all sides. Again, the humanitarian space is shrinking. There are restrictions being placed on what they can or can't do. They're being told that though they perceive themselves to be neutral actors in providing humanitarian assistance, you're either with us or against us, and both sides seem to feel that way and threaten them easily. Security is horrific and deteriorating. There is a climate of fear in Mogadishu and beyond. The insurgency tactics have already been described by Leslie. I would update that only marginally by saying that since the very powerful counterinsurgency attacks in late April, launched primarily by the Ethiopians, which initially appeared to have crushed the insurgency, what it in fact did is it just changed their tactics. And what they're doing now is less of the mortars from the neighborhoods, which presented the Ethiopians with a discrete target to attack. Now what we're seeing are tactics that seem to be borrowing a page from the insurgency in Iraq, and that is to say much greater use of roadside bombs, improvised explosive devices that target the primarily the TFG or Ethiopian convoys, the daily use of grenade attacks thrown primarily against TFG targets, a congregation of police or others, political assassinations, which is now a tool of choice by both sides. It was honed by the Shabab. That's something that they were doing. They had a dirty war there since 2004. But there's now evidence to suggest that the TFG is also partaking in that. And, of course, the use of threats on a daily basis. The Somalis that I talk to, who've been very steadfast and loyal friends and colleagues over the year, who've always been willing to share information with me, are recounting tales of how they and their family members are being called, threatened on a daily basis, and it just makes it very, very difficult to live there. And, of course, it also makes it very, very difficult to get good information as to what's going on, and that serves the interests of both sides, not just one. Politically, there has been no transition now for almost 3 years in a government that has a 5-year mandate to advance the transition. There is a sneaking suspicion among some of us that they really aren't that interested in a transition. They don't see themselves as a transitional government, or maybe to put a more sophisticated spin on it, they're seeing the transition in a different way than we are. We're approaching the transition as the type that we saw in Burundi and Democratic Republic of the Congo, namely a government of national unity that has principal responsibility for creating conditions that will move the transition on to culminating in an election. There is another model of political transition. It's the Ethiopian model in 1991-94. That was a transitional government. And like many transitional governments, that one was actually intended to consolidate power, not to create conditions to share power. And I think we need to be very, very lucid about the difference between what we're talking about with political transition and governance and what local Somalis are thinking and saying about these things. There has been no broadening of the TFG. There's been a narrowing of the TFG. The parliament has now been purged of opposition. This creates a major problem for the transition, because if we can ever get those key transitional structures and processes moving forward, they now have nothing to turn those essential laws, transitional laws, to that represents the voice of the nation. It now, at least temporarily, is a very narrow parliament. As a result of the very narrow, the lack of inclusion, the lack of expansion of the TFG, it continues to face a legitimacy crisis among a broad range of opponents, including both Islamists and non-Islamists, violent and non-violent. There's been no serious effort to find common positions for dialogue between the real opposition and the TFG. And this is one of the aspects of what's been going on now in Nairobi, Addis, and Mogadishu that's really frustrating. You don't have to have a PhD in political science to understand negotiations 101. When you've got two parties in conflict, if you're going to hold a conference to bring peace, to end the conflict, it does improve your odds a great deal if you actually bring representatives of the two groups that are fighting. If you bring a bunch of other people together, you can have a nice talk, but that's not going to end the conflict. And if we had tried to do this anywhere else in the world, would have been laughed at. Can you imagine taking on the Israeli-Palestinian crisis that way, bringing people who had nothing to do with the actual conflict to the table and pretending that it's a dialogue for reconciliation? And what's even more annoying is that these are very seasoned diplomats in Nairobi who know better. The Somalis are expert negotiators. They know better. The Ethiopians are expert negotiators. Everyone knows better. We are sitting around at times. It's almost like the emperor with no clothes. You watch these proceedings, and you can't believe that we're taking some of this as seriously as we are. There is, to go on with the political crisis, no indication now that Ethiopia will pull its forces out soon. This was something that comes as a surprise to me. I really did expect that they would pull out earlier. There are costs. There are financial costs. There are diplomatic costs to staying. But now we're starting to get, after 8 months, more indications that they will stay on as long as they think they need to. And there is no sense that many of the Somalis at this point believe that the transitional federal government itself will last. And one of the most worrisome indicators on that score is the rise of, or the revival of, warlordism in Mogadishu. And some of them are old warlords that have been around for a while, but some of them are new. And guess where they're housed? They're housed inside the transitional federal government. They are top leaders who are commanding security forces that are technically part of the transitional federal government, but which are answering only to them, beginning to carve out fiefdoms, clearly in anticipation that the TFG is not going to succeed. There are some other problems that we haven't talked about. One is the two of the most important stable regions of Somalia, Puntland and Somaliland, have been ignored. We have ignored them at our peril. They are not doing well. Puntland, in some ways, is being pulled down by the dynamics in southern Somalia. About half of its port revenues are being drained to Mogadishu to support that particular political enterprise. They are not able to pay their security forces. Security has been a major problem for both locals and for international NGOs. The international NGOs actually pulled out of Puntland not long ago. That prompted a major crisis. The good news is they seem to be patching things up. The elders are coming in and saying, we will start to take care of the security that we expected the government to do, but they're unable to do. Puntland is fragile, and that is a mistake on our part not to be shoring up these places, these zones of recovery and stability that have somehow managed to survive 17 years of enormous challenges of state collapse. Likewise, Somaliland has gone to the brink in the past couple of months over politics related to its upcoming elections in April 2008. The good news is they seem to have stepped back from the brink in the past week, but that is a situation that certainly should not be taken for granted. Then there's what's happening to the west, in eastern Ethiopia. Somali regional state, where I happen to have begun my fieldwork this summer in the region. To give you some background as to what's going on there, because it has received some news, but it was all during the summer, and many of you were happily taking your vacation then. The Ethiopian intervention into Somalia was done with a certain amount of redeployment of or deployment of their forces that had been in Somali region into Somalia itself. And that created some opportunities for the largest, really the only significant armed insurgency group in the area, the Ogaden National Liberation Front, or from here on out, ONLF, to begin mounting more aggressive campaigns. The ONLF is one of two major armed insurgency groups in Ethiopia, along with the Oromo Liberation Front. There are others, but these are the two big ones. Neither has ever threatened the existence of the Ethiopian government or is in any position to today. They're a nuisance. But what was happening is the ONLF was becoming more of a nuisance, launching more daring attacks, holding towns for hours or even days, attacking army barracks, and then all that culminated in April of 2007 when they launched an attack of unprecedented scale at an oil exploration site in Dagabur, eastern Ethiopia, killing 74 people, mostly Ethiopian security forces, but also including 9 Chinese oil workers. That was a major challenge to the government of Ethiopia. It's going to cost Ethiopia a lot because the Chinese have not come back yet. The Ethiopia feels very threatened by this and went after the ONLF with a major military campaign beginning sometime in May. The basic features of that military campaign have included a policy of collective punishment meted out against the Ogaden clan, roughly, again, I'm going to use very broad figures here, but about half of the Somali population of Ethiopia and Somali regional state, about 2 million of the 4 million that we think live there, even the population figures are under dispute, are from the Ogaden clan, and they are the core supporters of the ONLF. The ONLF claims to get support beyond the Ogaden people, but the name itself gives it away a little bit. They are basically the Ogaden National Liberation Front. The government, the Ethiopian National Defense Forces have been targeting that clan specifically, not targeting the other clans. In fact, their policy of divide and rule, arming the other clans, using them as paramilitaries against the ONLF and the Ogaden people, which as a short-term counterinsurgency tactic is very effective, as we know from places like Sudan, and in the long term almost guarantees those populations years and years of communal violence and reprisal attacks. There is also a policy of disproportionate response. The Ethiopian National Defense Forces have burned villages. They have committed a variety of atrocities against the civilian population. And then there's been a policy of using food as a weapon. This is a classic counterinsurgency tactic of draining the swamp, trying to create a situation in which rural dwellers move into protected urban areas so that the ONLF is exposed in the countryside. And they've done this through a variety of means. One is they have a commercial blockade, an unofficial commercial blockade on Ogaden-inhabited areas. That has recently been partially lifted because there's a UN fact-finding mission that is traveling through the countryside. But what that did, that commercial blockade, created an immediate food crisis in the region. Almost all the population there are either pastoralists or they're small-town dwellers. They're very reliant on commercial shipments of food, mainly through Somaliland, also further south from Somalia itself. Without that, prices doubled and tripled in some cases for basic food items. That was very, very threatening to the poorer rural dwellers and poor townspeople. Second, there has been, for bureaucratic reasons, a suspension of all food aid into eastern Ethiopia, into Somali region, since late 2006. It has nothing to do with the counterinsurgency, but it's a very unfortunate combination because of a change in their policies. They have a new, actually a very thoughtful, potentially very positive program called the Safety Net Program to address chronic food needs, but because of lack of capacity, they haven't been able to get that off the ground. There's 1.1 million Somalis who are identified as chronically in need of food assistance in Somali region. So right there, you've got two elements that could potentially create a major humanitarian crisis. When you add to that the protected village strategy that the Ethiopian government tried to initiate there, compelling rural dwellers to move to safe areas with their herds, threatening if they don't, we'll burn your village down. That would have produced the perfect storm, and that's that because mobility is the number one mechanism for survival and risk management in that part of the Eastern Horn. If you're reducing the mobility and blocking commercial food shipments, there would be some Somalis in some very, very serious trouble quickly. And that remains the consensus view among humanitarian aid agencies and governments, donor governments in Addis, that within weeks we could still have a major humanitarian problem on our hand in eastern Ethiopia if those policies aren't lifted. The most important one, well, let me back up and say that the effort to concentrate Somalis in safe areas largely failed. The Somali pastoralists understood what would happen if they moved all their herds to one area. It would immediately reduce the carrying capacity, and their herds would suffer and die, and they would be in huge trouble. So what they opted to do instead, by and large, is flee into the countryside, not too far from their home villages, but in that general area. The solution to this from a humanitarian point of view is pretty clear. The commercial blockade is key. If you lift that, if you find a way to allow Somali traders to move back into the areas with commercial food items, the pastoralists who have good herds, there have been good rains, thank God, for the past two seasons, will be able to trade their animals now that it's the dry season for rations, and that, more than the food aid, will certainly help solve the problem. In fact, the food aid is generally a part of the problem there. The food aid is not monitored. The distribution of it is not easily monitored by World Food Program and others. It's in the hands of a bureau of the Ethiopian government, the regional government, and there have been widespread allegations of misallocation of the food aid. What else to say? All this is not in the interests of the United States, nor is it in the interests of the Somali people, nor is it in the long-term interests of the Ethiopian government, in my view. This is what we are facing today is a series of calamities that are driven in large part by policies taken by internal and external actors that are inadvertently working against their interests, not for their interests. For us, this is creating conditions that are radicalizing populations that are blaming the U.S. for the actions of Ethiopia. And make no mistake, when you talk to Somalis, they link what Ethiopia is doing and what the TFG is doing to what we want them to do. And you can argue until you're blue in the face that that is not what is happening, that Ethiopia and the TFG are their own independent actors. They're nobody's puppets. But the fact is, we are responsible. We are being held responsible for policies that we don't always agree with, and that, worse, are undermining rather than advancing our long-term interests. In the case of eastern Ethiopia, the thing that concerns me the most is that Ethiopia, which is a strategic ally of ours and which has legitimate security concerns which Somalis don't fully appreciate, and that's part of the long-term solution, I think, is getting Somalis to appreciate, to accept that Ethiopia has long-term security, legitimate security concerns. But for the moment, Ethiopia is fighting a somewhat different war than we are in the region. By targeting the ONLF and the Ogaden people, they're actually creating conditions in which the Shabab, which is our real number one concern, are able to exploit in eastern Ethiopia. Could it get worse? Oh, yes. It could. The most likely scenario is that this is going to continue on much longer than we want it to. This could go on for some time. Ethiopia not leaving, no real reconciliation, the TFG continuing to muddle along, the insurgency continuing to flare up, displacement continuing to be very high. That is quite possible. In fact, that's usually a safe prediction in Somalia for things to go on longer than you expect. It could get worse, though, and one of the ways it could get worse is if the U.S. embarks on a series of policies that it hasn't embarked on yet entirely, but which is under discussion. If we demonize all of the players who are currently opposed to some degree to the Ethiopian government, we're going to slam the door on any prospects for political dialogue. If we, in fact, start by categorizing Eritrea as a state sponsor of terrorism. That is going to slam the door on dialogue there when we probably need some windows for dialogue with them. If there is some occasional discussion that the ONLF be designated a terrorist group, the Ethiopians are pushing very hard for that. They do consider the ONLF a terrorist group, but that too will slam the door on some possibilities for dialogue. And finally, if we treat the opposition as unacceptable, as groups we can't talk with, either because they are radical Shabab or, more often, because they haven't renounced violence, there too we have essentially forestalled any possibility for dialogue. The violence issue should be part of the negotiations. As I understand it, studying peace talks in a lot of other places, a cessation of hostilities is one of the things that you agree to early on. It's not a precondition for talks. The insurgents' only real leverage is the fact that they can resort to violence that's destabilizing, that's blocking the TFG. And so to insist on that as a precondition is essentially another way of saying there's not going to be any talks. There has to be more room for maneuver on that score. And let me finish with just a couple of thoughts about the three pillars of U.S. foreign policy currently and where they're likely to go. And you heard Deputy Assistant Secretary Swan talk about these three pillars. First, trying to get the African Union forces fully deployed and then transition to a UN mission. And why that's so important? It's important because we all agree that the continued presence of Ethiopian troops is the lightning rod for the insurgency. If we can get the Ethiopian troops out, then the insurgency is going to be dampened. It'll still be there, but it won't be as severe. I would argue, though, that we need to think very clearly about this reasoning. If a full deployment of African Union or UN troops are sent to Mogadishu, 8,000, 10,000, whatever, and if the Ethiopians do withdraw from Mogadishu, and make no mistake, they won't withdraw from Somalia. They'll withdraw maybe to Baidoa. They'll give themselves a buffer zone in southern Somalia. What will happen to the TFG? Will the African Union forces be able to protect the TFG? I was in UNISOM. We had 28,000 of the best soldiers from the strongest countries in the world, and we couldn't handle South Mogadishu. I wonder if the TFG could stay in Mogadishu absent the protection that the Ethiopians are currently affording them. It's a legitimate question to ask. What we might end up doing is pushing for a policy that could actually undermine. It would allow the Ethiopians to withdraw, and maybe that's what they want. Maybe they just want a fig leaf for a partial withdrawal, but I don't know that it's in the interests of the TFG. Second, the push for inclusion. Everyone agrees with the U.S. government position that we have to make the TFG more inclusive. If you get buy-in from the population in Mogadishu, if they're stakeholders in the outcome of the TFG, that will create a non-permissive environment for the insurgents. Again, it won't end the insurgency, but they will find that they're now operating in neighborhoods where people really don't want them there, as opposed to what's happening now, where they're getting passive acceptance from many in the neighborhoods. But again, we have to challenge some of the presumptions there. First and foremost of which is, do any of the main protagonists in the Somali drama want a more inclusive transitional federal government? Certainly the top leadership in the TFG doesn't, because that'll cost them their jobs. We all know this. They're fighting this tooth and nail because their seat is one of the bargaining positions were the TFG to become a true government of national unity. And on the other side, do the opponents of the TFG, not just the Shabab, which we know are spoilers, we know they are a long-term problem, but also just a lot of Somalis who deeply resent the TFG, its policies, its narrowness of its coalition, the fact that it's perceived by them, rightly or wrongly, as a puppet of the Ethiopians, they don't want to do anything to legitimize and rescue the TFG. They would rather watch it die slowly on the vine in the remaining 2 years of the transition. And this brings us back to the fact that the opposition in Somalia has one big advantage. They don't have to win. They can just play for a draw. And I think a lot of them are inclined to do that. Finally, capacity. Building the TFG's capacity is clearly an important policy objective. The TFG has shown very weak capacity to govern when set against the accomplishments of the courts in 2006. It's even more embarrassing to see how little they've been able to accomplish. So by all means, trying to build their capacity is important. But that begs another question. Capacity to do what? And one of the problems not just in Somalia, but throughout much of the Horn of Africa, is that the chief source of insecurity to the people living in these states, to citizens, are their own governments, whether it's Sudan or Somalia or arguably some others in the region. When the state is the enemy of its own people, when the state is treating its own people as foreigners, as is so common throughout much of the Horn of Africa, building the state's capacity is not necessarily an unmitigated good. There has to be more accountability to what the TFG expects to do with that capacity before we embark down that path as well. And that, of course, has been one of the greatest frustrations of all, is the complete lack of accountability that we've seen to the TFG. The TFG's main source of revenue is not foreign aid, which is what you might think it is. It actually is customs revenues and the many other ways that they can exploit their sovereignty. Many more ways than I realized. There's actually quite a few ways you can make some money by being a transitional sovereign government. They're making a lot more that way, and that's a problem because we have less leverage than we think we do. The foreign aid that we have will not necessarily change their behavior, and that again reduces some of the options that we have to look at. Thank you.
Ken, you certainly didn't disappoint us. Thank you very much. We have about 25 minutes for questions and comments, and if you'd raise your hand, and we'll bring a microphone to you. Yes. You want to identify yourself?
Sure. I'm Lawrence Freeman from Executive Intelligence Review magazine. Mr. Menkaus, you identified the TGF, the Ethiopians in the U.S., as not working towards a fruitful policy or working against each other. Yet these are the major players in the situation. So if they're not working towards a proper policy, then the opposite policy seems to be the spread of chaos, asymmetric warfare, and destabilization of the region. So how do you see, or what your recommendations are to get off the course we're on, and what, especially since our government is where we are, what should we be doing to bring us off this course? Because it's looking more and more like an Iraq in the Horn of Africa.
I've been giving a lot of thought to the "so what do we do then" question, and I'm going to disappoint you by not being able to give you a complete answer now. But let me give you some shards of half-baked ideas for what to do next. And again, I go back to my very first point, which is in 14 years, this is the worst I've seen in terms of just bad options. There's no silver bullet for anyone in all of this, but certainly one possible option I'd like to pursue and discuss more with Somali colleagues and international diplomats is the possibility of de-emphasizing the need for a government of national unity and the need for building the TFG's capacity. We're down to just a little over 2 years left on the TFG's transition. Let's see, what about focusing all of our energies and all of the Somali energies on the key transitional tasks. That is to say, the key parliamentary committees, the national electoral boards, the things that the minimal transitional structures and processes that have to be accomplished in order for Somalia to get through to roughly 2009, 2010 to complete the transition. Somalia is going to die a death by transition if we keep doing this transitional government that fails and then more peace processes and another transitional government that fails. And it gives spoilers an easy option. They can just wait it out again. Let's say, no, we're going to see this through until the transition is complete. Everyone is a stakeholder in a successful transition, but then create a firewall between these key transitional functions and structures and the TFG itself. Make them real repositories of inclusiveness, a transition of national unity if you can't have a government of national unity. What I like about that is it gives the international community very focused, discrete tasks to perform in support of this, and it's potentially win-win. The Somalis want this transition. It could bring a lot of different Somali groups who otherwise don't agree on much anything else together to hammer this out. And also, a lot of the technical, a lot of the transitional work that needs to be done is highly technical in nature. It's not intensely, I mean, it has intense political consequences, but it involves Somali lawyers and Somali, you know, other Somali election experts. We have a model that unfortunately is looking less promising all the time. But about 4 or 5 months ago, it was a great model, and that was the DRC. The DRC was paralyzed politically as a transitional government. It couldn't have governed itself out of a paper bag during the transitional period. But the international community focused on those key transitional tasks and actually saw it through. Now it's unraveling. And so I'm a little reluctant to use that as our model. But the precedent is there.
Steve?
The picture that you paint, I mean, I don't see necessarily any of this adding up to some shift of international approach, which is one of the issues that we wanted to talk about here. And I wanted to outline, I was just sketching out sort of what seemed to be some of the main major factors. There is no coherent diplomatic mechanism. There is this contact group, but it's intermittent, and there's no clear game plan driving it. There's no international force that is feasible or viable. In other words, the AU operation's kind of stuck, and there's nobody marching forward to push any other option. You have there's no real humanitarian tripwire at the moment. Yeah, it's miserable, awful situation, but it's not pushing towards this is intolerable. In fact, our levels, as Leslie pointed out and you pointed out, our levels, the legacy of Somalia is a level of tolerance and cynicism that is quite exceptional and gives us quite a bit of elasticity for dealing with these kinds of situations. And the parties themselves, the Somalis themselves, have become more polarized, less polarized. The current transitional arrangements and game plan lack, as you point out, lack legitimacy. So there's not, you can't even get the parties themselves sort of organized around it. And with the intervention of the Ethiopians, with the backing of our U.S. government and others, it's kind of turned into a situation where it's not one of resolution. It's not one in which people are aiming towards a resolution. It's becoming a policy of containment, in effect. It's avoiding other outcomes we don't want to see. If you're pursuing particularly a counterterrorist, or if you're the Ethiopians and you just want to contain the Eritrean entrenchment and the ONLF, and chaos is not a desirable outcome, but it's more desirable than some other outcome. And the last factor is just Darfur sucks the wind out of everything. So when you're putting 26,000 forces into Darfur, when Sarkozy, Blair, the Chinese, and others are fully mobilized around the P5 around those issues, there ain't a whole lot of energy and time left for something like this. All of those things, it seems to me, argue for us sitting down in another 3 to 6 months and having the same conversation. Maybe some of you can respond to whether you think that's overly cynical or not.
First, in terms of just general cynicism and that topic, I want to emphasize that in the short term, I'm quite pessimistic, as I made myself clear, I think. But in the longer term, I'm not. I think there are reasons to be very hopeful. We have seen some extraordinary levels, excuse me, both of economic innovativeness and dynamism in Somalia, despite the collapse of the state, and political adaptability, the many forms of local governance that have sprung up. There's a lot of reason for long-term hope in Somalia, but in the short term, this is in fact a very pessimistic time. And I agree with you that the region sucks the winds out of sustained attention to Somalia, and it's not just Darfur. The CPA is not being implemented. For those of you who don't pay attention to Sudan, watch carefully, because this is going to be a real nightmare if this continues. And now this is one of those concerns that kind of ebb and flow once a year. But right now we're definitely in flow mode when it comes to concern about the possibility of renewed Ethiopian-Eritrean hostilities in the coming year. There are a number of warning signs about that. Who knows if it'll happen or not, but these are the kinds of things that can even more divert attention in the Horn of Africa from Somalia. This brings up an interesting observation I heard from some Somalis during my summer. The rumor, And of course, these rumors aren't true, I'm sure, but it doesn't matter. Well, what matters is that they're rumors, and that Somalis are hearing them, is that the United States has a plan B for if the TFG doesn't succeed. And it is exactly what you said, to fall back to just treating Somalia as a CT problem, a counterterrorism problem. Forget it. You guys can't agree politically. We're not going to engage you politically. We'll just engage you on our core concern, counterterrorism. That would be a terrible mistake on our part. I don't think that ignoring the political dynamics in the country is an option. What we have to be doing is thinking about, okay, if this particular political route isn't working, if at some point the TFG is – it may still have a year and a half or so on its mandate, but it's dead in the water. Can we start to do something else? Is there some other mechanism for getting Somalis to dialogue? And again, maybe through a transitional set of transitional tasks.
Jeff?
Yeah, just a remark on Steve, what you said. I would go back to pointing to the what has been mentioned earlier, which is the extremely high threshold level when it comes to humanitarian intervention in Somalia. The intervention in the early 90s came extremely late. It came after the peak of the crisis. It came probably after the peak of the crisis. And subsequently, and for all kinds of reasons, the humanitarian response in the intervening years certainly has been inadequate in terms of meeting the needs of the population. I'm making this point not to downplay the particular humanitarian concerns that exist today, because they are there, they are extreme, they've been noted here this afternoon. They need a stronger response, and that's incumbent upon all of us to try to deliver. But we do not have a good record of being responsive, and one feature of that, of course, is our difficulty to have access and the difficulty to be present in Somalia, to witness and to be effective in terms of aid delivery. And I think all of us hope that we don't pay any price for that as we go forward, but it's a significant concern, and that's independent and irrespective of but related to the political framework.
I'd just like to add, I can't say... I agree wholeheartedly with much of what Ken Menkaus has mentioned. There's just a couple of points I'd like to put a bit more emphasis on. One is, I think, I don't think we've seen the worst yet. I mean, I think, obviously, you mentioned the Ogaden. This is of huge concern. I think when you look at what the situation there, you see an intersection, maybe at a smaller scale, of two conditions that we saw in Darfur, a counterinsurgency strategy and a blockage of humanitarian access, which combined to create on a much greater scale, the kind of catastrophe we've seen in Darfur. We could see something of that level of calamity, if not of scale, in eastern Ethiopia. I think the other issue, though, in the broader picture, I mean, one thing that was very, very interesting we haven't talked about is not mentioned in this report, but another piece of research that we've been doing is on renditions in the region. And I just want to raise this briefly because, very, very, very in summary, there were several hundred people who were detained in Kenya when they fled Somalia in December, January, February period. Many of these people were arrested, held in Kenyan prisons, deported from Kenya, including Kenyan citizens, deported back to Somalia and then sent on to Ethiopia, where they've been held for many, many months. Some dozens were released, but many more have continued to be held, including women and children. And the depth of resentment that some of these issues, the renditions issues, counterterrorism policy in Kenya, the resentment that this has created among certain communities runs very deep. So I think when we talk about containing Somalia, that's not possible. It's not just an issue of the refugee flows. It's an issue of the perceptions, whether rightly or wrongly, of the U.S. role in the region. And I think, as Ken mentioned very, very rightly, whether or not Washington really is directing policy, it's perceived as doing so in much of the region. And perception, of course, is crucial, whatever the reality going on, and particularly when you're talking about the potential for radicalizing populations in the region. And again, as Ken mentioned, working against perhaps our own U.S. interests. And so I think that it could get much worse, and this is of huge concern. We know a lot about what is happening. We shouldn't have to wait another 6 months to see things get worse.
Yes. Go ahead. Wait for the microphone.
My name is Dave Sheikh. I'm with the Mars Group. My question from Leslie. You mentioned it. You have a report about the last 6 months. And as you know, Somalia have civil war for longer than that. What happened before? Why don't you didn't talk about it for the past 16 years and you just talk about this time?
It's a very good question, and I don't have a very good answer. It's true that for Human Rights Watch, as an institution, we haven't done any serious research on Somalia for about 13 years, and there isn't a good justification of that. And the reasons why we are coming back to the region have to do not only with the scale of the crimes and with the political importance and the strategic importance of what is happening, but also just with pure issues like capacity internally. As I said, I don't have a good answer for you. One thing I'd like to mention is, of course, you know, in focusing on these events, we would certainly not be minimizing the gravity of other crimes that have been committed in the last 10 years. And one of the recommendations we do make in the report is we recommend that the UN actually establish some kind of an independent group of experts. There, of course, is an independent expert on human rights in Somalia, but to create a panel of experts who would actually try to map many of the most serious crimes over the last 16 years, or perhaps longer, and make recommendations on how to address these kinds of crimes. It's not an easy thing to do, to look back at 17 years of crimes and figure out how to address them. But we think it is very much something that needs to be discussed, how this could be addressed. And this, of course, is a conversation that would have to be largely among Somalis and with Somalis, but it's one that we think should be started.
In the back of the room. We'll be next.
Yeah. First of all, I would like to thank CSIS for everything they have done. It has been consistent from the invasion throughout the crisis, how they remain loyal to the cause of trying to bring Somalia to the world and world's attention. I thank you. Secondly, both Ken and Leslie have talked about tremendously what's happening in Somalia. I grew up with that crisis in Somalia. We get up as Somali Americans from 2 a.m. until 6 in the morning, our phones ring off the hook, and then in the morning we go to work, whatever we need to do as American citizens to be productive. So you can tell our pains. Now my question is, our government here in the United States, Washington, is trying to sustain a program that's not sustainable, which is the 4.5. It's like dividing this room into blondes, whites, and blacks, blue eyes and brown eyes, and saying each should have one number, 4.5, and that should rule United States. And, of course, all of those being the warlords that devastated Somalia for the past 16 years. Now, my question is, with all the rendition programs, by the way, which is not only few caught from, hundreds caught from Kenya, and sent to Ethiopia. We know where the prisoners are. They're in Jigjiga in Ethiopia. Majority of the people are from Mogadishu. Men have been pulled out of their homes in the dead of the night. Young men, and they don't only include Somalis. They're Oromos who live there also from the 70s who don't even know where Ethiopia is, who were born there. So please, let's talk about the issues. I'm sorry that the gentleman from the State Department have left because he is trying to his administration is trying to sustain something that's not sustainable. So what can we do to address the real issues, which is that TFG is a government, is a warlord invested government. It's like asking a raped woman to be consoled by the raped. How can that happen to Somalia? And how can we ignore Somalia and pretend that we care about just peace and equality? As an American, puzzles me. Truly, it bothers me. And I'm disturbed by that.
We're going to take two final questions and then have the panelists respond to that. Yes.
My name is Abdul Salam. I'm from Somalia. I'm a businessman. All my kids are born here. And for 17 years, we've been waiting for Somalia to come back so I can take my kids back there and maybe make some more business again. My question is, there are a lot of problems in Somalia, and there have been for 17 years. And I always come to these meetings for, you know, saying maybe some hope to live with, but we always seem to be emphasizing on the problems but not solutions. And what I want to talk about is the United States government, for the first time, when there is a superpower that's left in the world today. And instead of discouraging the United States government, I believe we need to encourage and come up with solutions, because if there's anyone who can help Somalia, I believe it's the United States government. Because everybody else have been trying for 17 years and they failed. And my suggestion is for the experts like CSIS, which I thank for always bringing the issue of Somalia into the minds of the United States, to at least come up with solutions of how in Somalia we have a government that's for the first time represented by all the states of Somalia. It's like having a federal government that's represented by the 50 states, not only one state or two states or three states. But it's weak, maybe it's corrupt, it's sick, but that has to be helped. And institutions have to be built. $40 million cannot build a school in Washington, D.C. I come from Loudoun County, and the school administration in Loudoun County has a $700 million budget. Just the school. An elementary school, just for rehabilitation, has been given $20 million. And we expect to give $40 million for a whole nation to be rebuilt. We need to be serious. If we need to help the United States government, I believe if we want to help Somalia, we can. This nation, I wonder sometimes if the same institutions and organizations that are always commenting about Somalia were there after the Second World War, what would have Europe been today? I think the same situation in Africa would have existed in Europe today. Europe has been rebuilt by the Marshall Plan. We need SATO instead of NATO. We need the South Atlantic Treaty Organization, because Africa is the Southern Atlantic. That's what rebuilt Europe. African Union needs to be rebuilt like the AU has been rebuilt. So we need to be serious. Oprah Winfrey gave $40 million to a school in South Africa, while the United States government gave $40 million to the Somali government. That's ridiculous.
I think we have to wind up.
Okay, I'm very sorry. I'm a little emotional. And my last question is, if Iraq, after $400 billion, 150,000 of the best army in the world, 4 years involvement, is still where it is in the green zone, what do we expect from Somalia with $40 million and about 8 months, whatever?
Okay. Take the final question in the very back there.
Jerry Hyman at CSIS. I was wondering if you could flip your skepticism a bit and address it from the other side. And one of the criteria for getting some kind of stability is some reasonable consensus amongst all the parties that they are going to be in a state and what the rules of that state are going to look like and so on. And I wonder if you could sketch out a little bit your thoughts about whether such a negotiated arrangement is possible and what it would consist of. We've talked a lot about all the reasons why it can't. What is there a possibility of getting some kind of agreement amongst the various different parties, leaving aside the neighbors? And what would that look like?
Yeah, I think as a final comments from all three of you, if you have any thoughts on moving forward, where we might go, what U.S. policy might look like, what looks like it's the most promising way to advance. Jeff, do you want to start?
Yeah, I just respond to the gentleman then, who spoke about the need for support and the role of the international community towards Somalia in the past 17 years. And I would just echo our experience, the inadequacy of the humanitarian component of the international community's response. I'm not competent to talk about the political or economic or other interventions, but certainly from the humanitarian component, we have not served the country well. We have not brought the kind of needs that are there. That being said, the need to develop a kind of partnership with the country, with institutions, infrastructure, civil society in the country is generally a prerequisite to being effective and to being able to be sustainable in terms of that part of the international community. The fact that has proved elusive is not an excuse for the inadequacy of the response. And the kind of continual inadequacy of a response to the emergency humanitarian concerns. We don't even speak development here. That is a feature of Somalia that has always been a feature over the past couple of decades. And I think those of us who have worked there and share in the plight of the country through this turmoil of the last decades are more than aware and sensitive to that point. And I think it's important that it's raised here today.
Leslie, do you want to?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to just, you know, I raised sort of my very negative first impression of Somalia and the lack of response to the crisis. Let me just throw in my very strong positive impression, which particularly when you compare Somalia to, for example, Sudan, where I've worked for many years, and Ethiopia, I think Ken mentioned earlier the role of civil society, and that is certainly, I think, a dramatic positive an optimistic side of Somalia when I look at what has been happening. You know, the role of the Somali media, for example, in trying to get the information out there about what has been happening over the last year with every change of political or military authority in Mogadishu. There's been some very valiant work, I think, done there. Many, many of the NGOs, the civil society groups, struggling against great odds. And I think that, you know, for the international community, such as it is, whatever that may be, supporting these efforts is a very, very, should be a very, very key prong of any policy. In terms of U.S. policy, let me just make one comment, which is that I think, you know, I think the gentleman here asked a question earlier and said, you know, why does the U.S. call Darfur genocide, and then there's sort of no comment about what has been happening in Mogadishu. And I think that's a fair question. I mean, I would certainly not want to open up the debate about what is genocide or what is not and whether U.S. designation of Darfur as genocide is good or accurate. But I think that a certain amount of consistency in response to what we see as massive human rights crises and serious international crimes would be invaluable in increasing U.S. credibility, which in many places internationally is in decline when it comes to human rights issues, given Guantanamo, given Iraq, given many other issues. And this, of course, has enormous impact on, I think, the ability of the U.S. to carry out effective foreign policy. So I think I guess the bottom line would be, I think that the message needs to be given, the signal needs to be sent that being a counterterror partner of the U.S. is not a carte blanche to commit serious international crimes and atrocities, which I think is currently the perception among many in the region that Ethiopia has been given this kind of carte blanche. And this is certainly not going to help to stabilize the region now or in the long term, as long as this kind of perception persists.
Ken, we'll give you the last word.
Thank you. If I could start with U.S. foreign policy, I was pretty hard on my friends in the U.S. government today. So this is your question gives me an opportunity to make amends by saying it's been the case that the U.S. government has been trying very hard and with good faith over the past couple of years to try to make something positive happen in Somalia. The efforts to bring the TFG and the CIC together for dialogue in the latter half of 2006 for several months, that was a hard-fought and ultimately fruitless battle, but that was really done with the very best of intentions, and was the solution, the opportunity that was lost, I think, that I wish we all had over again, but which was sabotaged. And I share Deputy Assistant Secretary Swan's assessment that was mainly the extremists in the CIC who marginalized the moderates, who I think were willing to make that deal. U.S. foreign policy since has been you know, one of the problems, of course, is deconflicting state building and counterterrorism agendas. I mean, those things can work at odds. Finding ways to ensure that U.S. counterterrorism concerns are addressed without overwhelming our other agendas remains, I think, a constant struggle. And then, you know, we have to keep in mind that the U.S., like everyone else in the international community, is facing a lot of bad choices in Somalia. And then once choices are made, we get locked into them. Once you back a transitional federal government that's the product of a not ideal, possibly illegitimate – I mean, I'm not going to pass judgment on that. There are Somalis, though, who argue that the TFG's creation itself was not legitimate. It certainly was less than ideal. But once you back it, now it has it's got – sovereign status for a 5-year transitional period, and it's very hard to wiggle out of that. The Somali businessman, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. Your concern about the amount of international assistance Somalia requires, and the comparison with the Marshall Plan is an interesting one. And it is certainly plausible that if we really threw billions and billions at Somalia, we could somehow, you know, drown it in cash. We had experience with that in UNISOM. We dropped a couple billion on Mogadishu in UNISOM, and while that didn't stop the fighting or allow us to succeed, it did change a lot of the behavior in Mogadishu. A lot of warlords shifted to landlords thanks to the – no, they did. And I mean, in some ways, the rise of the very impressive Somali business class is partially can partially be attributed to the money that we – it wasn't our intent, but we helped create them. But I think another interesting analogy would be Somaliland, which has managed over the past decade to govern itself reasonably well and create an environment for – again, reasonable economic recovery with almost no foreign aid and with a national budget that ranges between $20 and $35 million a year. So I don't want to I mean, we need to be open to the possibility. Somalia's not going to get a Marshall Plan, I guess, is the short answer. And so the alternative might actually be trying to find ways to imitate what has been done in other places with very small sums of money. And then finally, the challenge to come up with some with opportunities for Somali consensus and a way forward for both the Somalis and the U.S. government. There is a possibility for consensus. Right now, Somali politics is incredibly polarized. I mean, it's – and why not? I mean, look at what has happened in the past year and a half. These are conditions that would polarize any country on earth politically. But for those of us with a longer history and recollection of Somalia, all the Somalis in the room for starters, and then a handful of us who've worked in Somalia for many years, I mean, Somalis are incredibly pragmatic politically. They are willing to, after years of fighting, reach an accord, and then it's just ended in a way that surprises a lot of foreigners. I don't know if it's forgiveness or forgetfulness or just pragmatism, but Somalis do have a way of reaching a deal that defies a lot of expectations when it's in their interest. And so, of course, the key there is creating conditions to tap into that pragmatism. And I would say, of course, there are lost causes in Somalia. There are political leaders who are just hopelessly corrupt, and they are always going to approach reconciliation and state building from a very narrow, how can I get as many millions out of this as I can? There are also lost causes among some of the hardliners and the Islamists, the Shabab. Now, these are killers. These are dangerous people. I don't know how Somalis are going to manage that. But then there's everyone else in between, and when they're not being assassinated, they have lots and lots of potential of reaching compromises. One of the things that's a precondition is I think we need to start encouraging Somalis to think more about providing one another and Ethiopia, and Ethiopia has to be thinking the same way, providing security guarantees. Right now, everyone is providing their security at someone else's expense in Somalia, and all that does is reinforce the problem. There are ways of providing security guarantees that would reduce some of these tensions. And then another approach that I think might work, and this is not popular among many Somalis, but I'm going to say it anyway, is the number one source of conflict in this country is the state itself. That's the prize. That's what the political elite battles over and mobilizes their clans to kill one another for. And maybe the solution is in the short term. In the long term, you have any kind of state you want. But in the short term, go back to that financial question of this is going to be a place without a lot of money. Why don't we start talking about a very minimalist state in the initial years? So we don't have governments that are declared with 82 people in the cabinet and a minister of tourism, for God's sake. Let's focus instead of a state that's shaped in an hourglass with lots of ministers, no civil service, and then a big security force. Let's focus on the security, on the civil service. Let's focus on the core tasks that Somalis – Somali citizens most want from a central state but aren't getting. And we can ask them. It's not. I do ask them, and I think I already can anticipate some of the answers if we had a survey. They want travel documents. They want someone who is going to maintain control over the currency without making fortunes by, you know, off of the seigniorage. They want five or six other things. Let that very small civil service do it. Possibly, even if we really want to think outside the box, under international tutelage, have some kind of, not a trusteeship over a big state, but some form of a guarantee, a good housekeeping seal of approval that we are providing support, professional training, and so on to this civil service, and let the private sector and local governance structures do what they've been doing over the past 10, 15 years very effectively, and that is fill in the gaps for the rest. I think those are the kinds of, but I guess to wrap up, it's just I think we are at the point where looking for those solutions and looking for a consensus is going to require thinking outside the box in some big ways. And Somalis are actually pretty innovative politically at thinking outside the box. They can reconceive the state that's been inherited from the colonial era in possibly some ways it could be of use to other countries. Thanks.
Well, I want to thank the presenters once again. Thanks, Steve and his colleagues, for putting this on and organizing it, and thank you all for coming.